All right, so we're diving into these sources you've brought on voluntarism and anarchy.
Yeah, some really interesting stuff here.
Yeah, it seems like we're going pretty deep into the ideas of like individual liberty and self-ownership and even questioning the whole concept of government.
Absolutely. And tracing these concepts from early critiques of monarchy all the way to, modern day arguments for free markets and limited government.
So kind of like a historical journey of ideas.
Exactly, yeah, a journey through the evolution of thought on individual liberty.
I guess to even start, maybe we should define some of these terms.
Yeah, good point. Where do we even begin?
Well, the Voluntary's Handbook seems like a good foundation.
For sure, that's a great place to start. It lays out a really clear framework. Voluntarism, at its core, emphasizes the idea that, peaceful individuals shouldn't be controlled by others without their consent.
So it's all about consent.
Right, consent is key. And then you have libertarianism, which centers on this principle that it's wrong to use force against others.
Okay, so like non-aggression.
Precisely. And then there's anarchy, which is often misunderstood, I think.
Yeah, definitely. People often picture chaos.
Right. But it's not about the absence of rules, it's about the absence of a ruler.
So it's more about challenging the authority of the state than advocating for like complete disorder.
Exactly. It really makes us question, does the state actually have some unique moral authority that individuals don't?
That leads to a really interesting point that Sheldon Richman brings up in his work. With that concept of one moral standard for all.
Ah, yes, that's a key one.
He basically says that initiating force is wrong no matter who does it.
Right, and that really challenges how we typically think about government, doesn't it?
It does, because, I mean, if you condemn theft as immoral, then how can you justify taxation, which is essentially taking someone's property without their direct consent?
It's a powerful argument, right? And he uses some great examples to illustrate this point.
Yeah, like even FDA regulations, right? They restrict what people can eat or drink, even though we wouldn't tolerate someone like forcing another person to eat a certain way in a private setting.
That's a great example. It highlights the inconsistency in how we apply moral standards.
It makes you wonder, like, does the state's involvement somehow make an action morally okay when it wouldn't be otherwise?
It's a question worth pondering, for sure. Now, one of the sources we have here goes even further and claims that we actually exist in a constant state of anarchy.
Whoa, that's a mind bender.
Right, like how can that be when we have governments and laws and all that?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive.
Well, this idea is presented in Do We Ever Really Get Out of Anarchy? And it kind of flips the traditional view on its head. It suggests that we're always in some form of anarchy, whether it's market anarchy or political anarchy.
Wait, even within government?
Yeah. Even within these hierarchical structures, like governments themselves, there's this idea of anarchy within the
I'm
system.
not sure I follow.
Think about like conflicts within the government, right? Like a congressman misusing funds or something.
Okay.
There's no higher authority to like perfectly step in and enforce the rules. It becomes a power struggle within the system, much like how nations interact on a global scale.
So it's like anarchy on different levels.
Exactly. So even with these established governments, relationships and interactions can still be anarchic in nature.
That's a really interesting way to look at it.
It challenges our assumptions, right?
It does. So then, if we're always navigating some form of anarchy, what does it even mean to identify as an anarcho-capitalist?
Good question. What it means to be an anarcho-capitalist actually addresses that directly, and it emphasizes that it's not about predicting that anarchy will inevitably succeed.
Okay, so it's not like saying anarchy is the future, it's gonna happen.
Not necessarily, no. It's more about taking a firm ethical stance against aggression.
So it's moral principle.
Exactly. It's about separating what should be, ethically speaking, from what we predict will be in the real world.
That makes a lot of sense. It's not about saying everything will be perfect in anarchy, but rather it's about upholding this principle of non-aggression.
Right. It challenges the idea that anarcho-capitalism is just about dismantling governments and expecting utopia to magically appear.
Now, a lot of these sources we have here are really big on free markets,
Yeah, definitely. And for good reason.
arguing that they're not just morally superior, but also practically superior.
That's right. They make a compelling case for both the moral arguments rest on these two pillars, self-ownership and voluntary exchange.
Okay, so you own yourself and you're free to trade with others.
Exactly. And practically speaking, free markets have a pretty undeniable track record of generating wealth and lifting people out of poverty.
I mean, history seems to back that up.
It is, yeah. But there are counterarguments, of course, concerns about things like safety, fairness, and monopolies.
Of course. So how does free market proponents address those?
Well, Walter Williams takes those head-on in the argument for free markets. He acknowledges that no system is perfect, but he argues that market-based solutions are generally better than government intervention.
Okay, interesting. So he's saying that markets tend to be more effective at solving problems.
That's the gist of it, yeah. He uses the example of steel import restrictions, I believe, and how they backfired. Trying to protect jobs in one sector actually led to job losses elsewhere because prices went up.
Ah, so it's about those unintended consequences.
Exactly. These things can have ripple effects throughout the economy.
Right. And Williams also addresses concerns about fairness and, you know, the whole idea of how wealth is distributed.
Yeah, that's a big one. He argues that income is earned by providing value to others, not distributed by some central authority.
So in a free market, you got to earn your keep by serving others.
Precisely. He contrasts that with, like, the welfare state, arguing that it creates a sense of entitlement without the obligation to contribute.
So you can get benefits without actually having to provide value in return.
Right, and he sees that as a kind of moral hazard. You're essentially bypassing the responsibility of earning your living by serving others.
I see. So it disconnects effort from reward.
In a way, yeah. And he's also pretty critical of central banking and its role in inflation. He argues that it disproportionately harms the poor because their savings lose value.
Right. Inflation hits those with the least hardest.
Exactly. So for Williams, economic freedom is very much tied to personal liberty and moral responsibility. It's all interconnected.
That's a pretty powerful link he's making there.
It is, and it gets to the heart of what a lot of these sources are trying to convey.
It's not just about economics. It's about how we organize society and interact with each other.
Now, another interesting point that's brought up is the concept of private governance.
Oh, right, like how people can create order and systems without relying on the state.
Exactly, and the sources provide some fascinating historical examples, like the early stock markets where traders developed their own mechanisms for ensuring compliance because the government refused to enforce their contracts. They built their own system.
So they created rules based on reputation and reciprocity, not government force.
Precisely. And those systems were remarkably effective. It makes you wonder if we could adapt some of those principles to address contemporary challenges.
Yeah, like even today we see the rise of online dispute resolution platforms and private communities with their own codes of conduct.
Right. It's like a modern echo of these historical systems. So there's definitely a lot to unpack here. It's a whole different way of looking at how societies can function. It's fascinating how history offers these, like, glimpses into different ways that societies have, like, governed themselves, you know?
You're right.
We just kind of assume that the state is the only path to order, you know, but all these sources you've brought up, they really showcase all these examples of private governance throughout history.
That's a great point. The Voluntarist Handbook actually dives into some really compelling cases.
Oh, yeah.
We already touched on those early stock markets, but it also explores things like merchant law and mutual aid societies.
Merchant law, that's a great one.
Yeah.
It emerged during the Middle Ages to deal with disputes between traders from different regions who were often operating outside of formal legal systems.
So basically, they built their own legal framework, just tailored to the needs of commerce.
Exactly. And these systems were surprisingly effective, you know, because they were grounded in, like, the practical realities of trade, you know what I mean? And they were enforced through things like reputation and social pressure.
So it was more about self-regulation than top-down control.
Right. It makes you wonder if we could, you know, adapt some of those principles to modern problems today.
It does. It really does. Because, like, even today we see these online dispute resolution platforms popping up and private communities that have their own codes of conduct.
Totally. It's like we're rediscovering these old solutions in a new context.
Exactly. Now, let's shift gears a little bit to mutual aid societies.
Okay, yeah.
They played a really important role, especially back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, offering, like, a safety net for working class people and particularly immigrants and minorities.
Right, a kind of community-based alternative to the welfare state.
In a way, yeah. Providing support and resources from within.
They were all about that solidarity, you know? Yeah. They offered things like insurance and health care and even death benefits to their members, all funded through these voluntary contributions.
And it really fostered this sense of community and mutual support, right?
Oh, absolutely. People taking care of each other.
The handbook even mentions that some of these societies would actually employ doctors and operate their own hospitals.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive.
Which challenges that assumption that only, like, these big centralized institutions can handle these kind of services, right?
It really does. It shows, you know, the power of communities to organize themselves and meet their own needs without relying on the state.
And it makes you think, you know, has the growth of government programs maybe actually crowded out these more localized voluntary approaches?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, the handbook even suggests that the decline of mutual aid societies was partly driven by government intervention. Yeah, they give the example of the AMA and their growing control over medical licensing.
Okay, so how did that impact things?
Well, it made it harder for these societies to offer affordable health care using their own doctors.
I see. So the state kind of stepped in and inadvertently created barriers that hurt these voluntary systems.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. And as the welfare state expanded, people naturally became less reliant on those community-based solutions.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Exactly.
The state steps in and then says, oh, look, we're indispensable now because everyone depends on our programs.
It's a recurring theme in a lot of these sources, you know, this challenge to the idea that the state is always the answer and that sometimes it might even be the problem.
Right, but let's not get too cynical here.
Oh, of course not.
Because these sources also offer some really empowering ideas about how individuals can reclaim their liberty and, you know, build a better world.
That's what it's all about, right? Empowering people.
Exactly. And that brings us to some of those modern anarchist and libertarian thinkers who emphasize the importance of secession and decentralization.
Right. A lot of them argue that breaking away from these big centralized states is crucial for achieving greater freedom and self-determination.
Like the whole idea of voting with your feet by moving to a place that aligns with your values.
Exactly. Choosing where you want to live based on your principles.
Some even talk about creating entirely new voluntary societies based on libertarian principles.
That's the dream for a lot of them, right? Building a world from the ground up.
It's a pretty radical concept. I mean, do any of the sources offer like practical ideas on how that could actually work?
Well, Hans Hermann Hoppe actually lays out this really intriguing strategy in one of the excerpts. He suggests starting small, you know, focusing on local communities that are already receptive to libertarian ideas.
So it's more about building a foundation gradually rather than trying to like overthrow the state all at once.
Exactly. It's a more organic approach. You create these pockets of freedom and prosperity that can serve as models for others.
Like real-world experiments in voluntary living.
Exactly. And Hoppe believes that the success of these communities would inspire others to follow suit, eventually leading to a more decentralized and voluntary world.
It's a vision that's both radical and hopeful. It's like, even if full-blown anarchy isn't feasible, these ideas offer practical steps that individuals can take to live more freely right now.
Absolutely. A lot of the sources really emphasize personal responsibility and self-reliance, and even peaceful non-compliance with unjust laws.
So it's about taking a stand against coercion in whatever ways we can.
Yeah.
Whether it's opting out of certain government programs or supporting alternative institutions or just living in a way that aligns with your values, even if it means going against the grain.
Right. It's about recognizing that we have agency. We're not just passive subjects. We can make choices that reflect our commitment to individual liberty, even within the existing system.
That's a powerful message. This has been a really thought-provoking dive into the philosophy and practice of voluntarism and anarchy. We've wrestled with some challenging concepts and encountered some really inspiring ideas.
Definitely a lot to think about.
I feel like we're just scratching the surface here, though.
I agree. This is really just a starting point. You know, there's a wealth of information out there for anyone who wants to dig deeper.
And I think one of the key takeaways from this whole deep dive is, you know, the importance of questioning assumptions and challenging conventional wisdom.
For sure. It's all about critical thinking.
We've been encouraged to rethink our ideas about the role of government, the nature of freedom, even the definition of anarchy.
And that's healthy for anyone, you know, regardless of their political beliefs.
Now, there's one final thought-provoking idea I want to touch on. One of the sources claims that the real political divide in America isn't between left and right, but between what they call the imposers and the imposed upon.
Yes, that's from Jeff Deist's speech, The Imposers and the Imposed Upon.
Right, that one really got me thinking.
It's a provocative take, suggesting that both major political parties in the U.S. kind of fall into that imposers category.
So it's not about those traditional labels, it's more like a mindset.
Exactly, a way of relating to power and control.
So how does he define these imposers?
He describes them as people who believe in this top-down approach to social change, using the power of the state to implement their vision, even if it means coercing others.
And the imposed upon are those who value individual liberty and self-reliance and voluntary cooperation.
Right, the people on the receiving end of those policies.
And Deist argues that this divide actually cuts across traditional political lines, right?
It does, yeah. It includes those who believe in using the government to enforce their moral or economic views on others.
He even suggests that this imposer mindset is at the root of a lot of the problems we face today.
Like endless wars and intrusive regulations and economic instability.
It's a bold claim, but it does make you question those deeper forces driving political conflict.
For sure. It challenges our assumptions about the nature of the political landscape.
He uses the example of the welfare state, right? arguing that it ultimately creates dependency and undermines individual initiative.
Yeah, the idea is that by constantly intervening in people's lives, the state actually weakens their ability to solve problems on their own.
It fosters a reliance on these external authorities rather than individual ingenuity and community solutions.
Right, people become depending on the system.
Fiesk seems to see this mindset as a form of arrogance, almost like a belief that a select few have the knowledge and wisdom to dictate how everyone else should live.
And he contrasts that with the humility of the free market, where individuals are free to make their own choices and learn from their mistakes.
It's a pretty powerful argument for empowering individuals and communities to take control of their own lives and destinations.
Absolutely. And it really speaks to those core principles of voluntarism, where individuals are free to pursue their own paths without interference from the state.
Speaking of taking control, a lot of these sources talk about building alternative institutions as a way to kind of circumvent the state and create spaces where freedom can flourish.
Yeah, it's about creating those parallel structures.
Exactly. And the suggestions range from practical things like homeschooling and private arbitration to those more radical ideas like building entirely new voluntary societies.
It's a spectrum of possibilities, right?
One source even talks about the potential of cryptocurrency to create a decentralized financial system outside of the control of governments and central banks.
That's a hot topic these days, for sure.
It's like putting those principles of voluntarism into action in a very tangible way.
Real-world applications.
And we see this growing movement of people exploring these alternative forms of community living based on self-governance and mutual aid.
Intentional communities and orco villages and things like that.
Right, it's like these experiments offer a glimpse into what a world with less state control could look like.
Exactly, showing what's possible.
And while there are definitely challenges and risks that come with any new venture, it's inspiring to see people pushing those boundaries and exploring new ways to live more freely.
I agree. It's exciting to see those ideas taking shape.
It all comes back to that question posed by one of the sources. If voluntarism is about maximizing individual choice and minimizing coercion, are there areas in your own life where you could apply these principles more fully?
That's a great question to ask ourselves.
Perhaps in your relationships, your work, or even your interactions with your local community.
It really challenges us to look inward, doesn't it?
It does. It makes you think about where you might be unconsciously accepting coercion or limiting your own freedom, and how you can live more intentionally in line with your values.
It's a call to action in a way.
It is. It's a reminder that freedom isn't just this abstract political concept. It's a way of life.
It's about how we choose to live each day.
It's about taking responsibility for ourselves, seeking out voluntary cooperation, and challenging those systems of control, even in our own lives.
It's about creating the world we want to see, starting with ourselves.
That's a powerful message to carry forward. It really is a lot to consider, you know. Especially that question from one of the sources about, like, you know, if voluntarism is about maximizing choice and minimizing coercion, are there areas in our own lives where we can, like, apply those principles more fully?
Yeah, that's a really powerful question, isn't it? It makes you think about, like, our relationships, our work, even just, like, our interactions in the community.
Totally. And it challenges us to think about, you know, like, where are we maybe, like, unconsciously accepting coercion or even limiting our own freedom? And how can we, like, be more intentional, live more in line with those values?
Right. It's a call to kind of examine our own lives and see where we can make those changes. You know, this whole deep dive has been super enlightening. I mean, exploring the world of voluntarism and anarchy, like, it's been really thought-provoking. We've looked at all these different perspectives, from the theoretical stuff to, like, the real-world implications.
And I hope it's gotten people thinking, you know, like, questioning some of their assumptions about government and freedom and all that.
I think that's one of the most valuable things about exploring these ideas, right? It encourages us to question things, to think about different possibilities, and to realize there's always more to learn.
So if anyone's feeling like their curiosity has been piqued by all this, there are so many resources out there, you know, to keep exploring these ideas.
Definitely. A ton of great stuff to dig into.
And remember, like, the journey of discovery never really ends. So keep those questions coming, you know, keep challenging the status quo, and keep seeking a world where individual liberty can thrive.
Well said. I think that's a great note to end on.